following program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.
This is Charles Ruas welcoming you to a program from my audio archives from the 1970s. As Director of Arts Programming at WBAI-FM, the Pacifica radio station in New York City, I produced programs that covered all the contemporary arts, including drama, literature, and experimental radio programs as well. The following program is a selection from a year-long series, The Reading Experiment of Marguerite Young's epic novel, Miss McIntosh, My Darling. The readings were performed by Marguerite Young's contemporaries from the New York arts community, a stellar cast of actors, writers, poets, and musicians. The Reading Experiment was produced at WBAI Pacifica in New York City, and was broadcast from 1976 to 1977. This program was restored in cooperation with the Beinecke Rare Books and Manuscript Library at Yale University and produced for broadcast by Art International Radio, operating out of the Clock Tower Gallery in New York City at artonair.org.
And this reminds me of one story that Marguerite told me, which I thought was so symbolical of her work. When she was a child and learning how to knit, she said she wanted to knit a scarf which would go all around the block. And I thought it was the most wonderful example of how much of the world she really wanted to include. She made no separation and no distinctions. The scarf had to go all around the block. Take the whole block in. And in a sense, that's what Marguerite has done. Taken the whole universe for us, the whole nightlife, the lives of all people almost, you feel, as you have lived it through. And her scarf, her book, does go all around the world.
Anaïs Nin, speaking about her friend Marguerite Young, the author of Prismatic Ground, Moderate Fable, Angel in the Forest, and Miss McIntosh, My Darling. The following program is about Marguerite Young's Angel in the Forest, a chronicle of New Harmony, Indiana, from 1814 to 1827. This secluded area was the scene of two utopias. Like the Cartesian split between body and soul, the Rappite, a scriptural communism founded by Father Rapp, a German peasant, who believed his people to be future angels. The Owenite, founded by Robert Owen, an English cotton lord who believed all men to be machines. The end result of Father Rapp's community, a celibate order, was heaven, and the end result of Robert Owen's, while also incalculable, was the British labor movement. Two utopias. The first, forerunner of a new Jerusalem, exclusive and arbitrary. The second, forerunner of a new moral world, to encompass all nations and all governments. Two utopias within a half mile square, surrounded by a vast wilderness, past, present, and future. Anaïs Nin will read her critical essay on Angel in the Forest.
For those who had the unique experience of reading Marguerite Young's Miss McIntosh, My Darling, Her Angel in the Forest, published 20 years earlier, will be a prelude to the vaster work concerned with the exploration of reality and illusion. In Miss McIntosh, My Darling, illusion stemmed from the opium dreams of the narrator's mother, which had to be disentangled before she could reach the end and purpose of her quest. This was a work of fiction. Angel in the Forest is a work of history. It deals with the creation of utopia, which was America's first illusion. This is the story of Father Rapp and Robert Owen's two experiments in social science, carried out in Indiana in the 19th century. The application of this theme to present-day problems makes it seem contemporary. When a poet chooses to write history, facts gain in power and in dimensions. Margaret Young is a meticulous scholar, but she illumines every description and every character with a laser light of significance. Her facts radiate wit and irony and are incarnated in human beings. Question: what is the nature of experience? What dream among dreams is reality? The place, New Harmony, is resurrected as if it had never faded. The title refers to giant footprints said to have been those of an angel on a stone, which a humble stone cutter saved from total obliteration, or perhaps carved upon the stone himself. Indiana is Marguerite Young's own native land. With a few vivid lines, she can summon up hundreds of its inhabitants with their many foibles, idiosyncrasies, fallibilities, to show how they sabotage their own idealistic conceptions. Mr. Pierce, the bookkeeper, dismissed for an error. True, he had drunk a little on the side now and then, but not enough to cause the dancing of arithmetic. Mrs. Pierce, who thought nothing so bad as despotism, which pretends to be democracy. Together they show a gradual waning of their hope for improvement at New Harmony. Human beings' own individual fantasies, hungers, obsessions, habits, defeat their own illusions. When the book was first printed during a paper shortage, too few people were privileged to read it. It contains the seeds of the major work to which Marguerite Young was to give 17 years of her life. History, she proved, was an aggregate of fictions, and she was to enter totally into the world of fiction, where she found many of the sources of mysterious failures. William Taylor, in view of his belief in the relativism and subjectivism of happiness, and his distrust of any value but pleasure, proposed that the Owenites gathered around him should hold a funeral for the science of society, all merry drunks to be the mourners, to build a coffin for the idea of all mankind, a featureless body. They worked as never before in the whole history of utopia. The relation of this experiment to the present shows its timelessness. It was necessary to bring out of the oceanic depths of the subconscious the sorcerers, apprentices, who undermined all social experiments. The author's two books invite us to sit at a giant conference table and parley with them. This conference table is also a banquet table of crystalline style and characters whose footprints to our own door Marguerite Young has carved.
Miss Nin's comments will be followed by an interview of Marguerite Young by Joan Schwartz and Charles Ruas. On October 25th, Marguerite Young visited WBAI in New York, where the following interview was recorded. Charles Ruas teaches at Columbia University. He is currently working on a project applying technology to the presentation of literary texts to investigate the interrelationship of visual and verbal understanding. Joan Schwartz is a video artist whose work has been shown here and abroad through the Stefanati Gallery in New York City. Her work in multimedia includes videotape, dance, and filmmaking. Both of them will interview Marguerite Young on New Harmony to give our listening audience a feeling of time and place through verbal maps and pictures, which are the basis of the storyteller's art. When you were writing Angel in the Forest, were you thinking of doing the portrait of a small town like Winesburg, Ohio, or Cranford, England?
No, I did not think of Winesburg, Ohio, for the reason that I had not yet read Sherwood Anderson. And I did not think of Cranford, perhaps because it was so ultra-typical and ultra-civilized. I did think, however, a great deal of Edgar Lee Masters' Spoon River anthology, and I thought also of Sir Thomas Gray's Elegy in a Country Churchyard. When I came to New Harmony, I had lived in and out of many Kentucky and Tennessee towns and had become very much fascinated by the individual history of each, such as Horse Cave, Kentucky, and the graveyards in those towns. So you might say I was a graveyard poetess at that time.
Did you go to New Harmony specifically to research the town, or you went there of your own accord?
I never did any research whatever on New Harmony. I would say the research took 3 days. My mother and stepfather moved there, and they called me. They were theater people. They owned small-town theaters. They called me to say, you'll love this new town. It's the scene of two lost utopias, and it has in it the footprints of the angel Gabriel, and it has a cruciform shapes on the doors and a maze and all these other beautiful objects. So when I went there, I simply lived there for 7 years, in and out, and gradually began to write about it, having already lived it. All I did was to check upon a few dates when I started. There was no artificial research, except through the experience of living there, talking to the beautiful old-timers in that town. Some were on the party of Father Rapp.
Who was
mainly,
the founder?
Who was the founder of the first utopia. And they loved him because he left visible evidence of his place. The cruciform, the maze, the sundial painted on the wall. Before the railroad, the sundial was the way you told time. There was no watch in general evidence until the railroad came to the land. There were all these beautiful things, plus the beautiful river people who lived there then. The landlord at Robert Owen's old hotel, the undertaker of the town who owned the deeds for property going back to Robert Owen and back to George Rapp. I saw the deeds going back to two utopias, which ironically became the possession of the undertaker, who was one of the most literate and beautiful men of that county, Mr. Perry Schultz. And I used to talk to him about the lost utopias.
You were going to do a series of poems?
I started with a series of 60 ballads in the Robert Browning manner, since I was a poet. And I was also interested in balladry. All that period, which was the end of the Depression, I had wanted to go through the Ozarks and through the Blue Ridge Mountains collecting ballads. I wanted to go on mule's back and collect American versions of Scottish ballads. Mm-hmm. I never could do that. But when I came to New Harmony, I found a living folklore that is really unique, because that is the only place where there were two utopias, one of married celibates and one of free lovers, one of evangelical, or not evangelical, I should not use that word, scriptural communism, and one which was founded by the father of the British labor movement, Robert Owen.
How did one utopia come out of the other?
Well, Father Rapp sold out the land to Robert Owen, who read an advertisement in the New York Times and fell in love with the description of the hattery, the cocoonery, the orchards, the meadows, the melon fields, the corn fields, the buildings, all the beautiful establishment which was already there. But by the time I came in 1940, we had the remnants of those two lost utopias combining.
First, tell our listener, where is New Harmony?
New Harmony is in the toe of the boot, that is, toward the toe of the boot, which is the shape of the state of Indiana. It is on the banks of the Wabash, which flows into the Ohio, and the Ohio then flows on into the Mississippi River. The ladies like to call Indiana the silk stocking state and call it the toe of the stocking. But back in these rugged frontier days, it seems to me that the boot state is more appropriate because it was founded by men with boots. Well, women too, but even they might wear boots in the wilderness. But when I came, as I said, there were the remnants, and there were I entered by waterway in the book. I often crossed by ferry boat the Wabash under the WPA bridge, which Roosevelt had built, but nobody could afford to go over the bridge. So it was empty all the time, and everybody laughed at Roosevelt's folly. Everybody took the ferry boat, and there you would summon the ferry boat by a great iron bell, which in 1940 had been at the river's edge for 50 years. It has, I understand it has been taken away recently, but I do think they should put it back, and they should put back the ferry boat too. Sandpipers, you see, running back and forth continually in the Wabash surf, and the holes, which were their nests, they are older than man. And to me, the symbol of the sandpiper, the beautiful nature which remains unspoiled in this country, is very evocative of the two utopias, which seem transient by comparison with the sandpipers and their holes, for example. They built no nests, and here were the two utopian communities which attempted to build nests. One founded upon the idea that the world would be destroyed by fire and brimstone almost immediately. Therefore, these married celibates had given up conjugal bliss and love. The other founded upon the idea of an eternal future and nothing supernatural in the universe, according to Robert Owen, although he did say, happiness is the instinct of the universe. And of course, that's a supernatural thought which he did not recognize, as there's no reason to believe that happiness is, that the universe has any instinct, but he believed it did have. As Father Rapp thought that it must all die and be born again. Well, I thought of the approach by water in the beginning of my book as a symbol of the lost Atlantean feeling, which was expressed later in literature, and that was that when the lost Atlantis sank, it heaved up America, and that the Mississippi River and lakes are part of that sea that was once there.
Was the location originally settled because it was like sort of the center of the land, the center of the country?
No. There was no idea of a center at this period. Beyond the Atlantic states, America was one vast wilderness. There were many people much later, at a much later period, who mistook Salt Lake City for the Pacific Ocean. People were still looking for the Northwest Passage, as you would know from reading the works of Mari Sandoz, for example, upon Buffalo Hunt. Everything was amorphous. Boundary lines were uncertain. It was the states were not even carved out, and many states which we now think of as being in the Union were not in the Union at all. It was one beautiful wilderness. There were no roads. It was before the gold rush. It was before.
Why did Father Rapp choose Indiana?
He first came from Württemberg, Germany, to look for a site, and first located near Pittsburgh, which was then a very small town, at a place he called Harmony. And when it became extremely flourishing, he sold it to move farther inward, because he apparently had to have the threat of nature in order to keep his community solidified. Now, this is one explanation given. He also had a son, John, who did not accept lightly the vow of celibacy, and whose wife became big with child. Now, this was in violation of the community religion. The true man was like the true angel, according to Father Rapp. He should be a hermaphroditic, both male and female, and there should not be this division of the sexes, and there should not be this lust for a woman. According to a rumor which may be not founded upon truth, but which was published in the Atlantic Monthly within 40 or 50 years of his death by old-timers, and was rooted about in the wilderness for years before that, his son died during an act of castration. He had with him a follower, a very brilliant follower, Frederick Reichardt, whom he then adopted and who went under the name Frederick Rapp, and who was one of the first senators of Indiana and was a liberal in all his thinking, unlike Father Rapp. So he came to a new wilderness and reproduced Harmony. Then when that became extremely prosperous, he would want to move again. Of course, he always wanted to move, even when he was an old man dying, and imagined, that was in Harmony, Pennsylvania, that he was the father of the Monroe Doctrine. He was planning to move to the Holy Land, and could not, of course, because, well, he went to whatever heaven there may be for one who believed so ardently in the next world. Another way he solidified his community was by his vision of the angel Gabriel, who came and left his footprints on stone. And in 1832, a traveler, an English traveler, Mr. Schoolcraft, identified them as the footprints of prehistoric Indian, not like those of any living Indian. The feet were so large, the toes were so large. It was an Indian runner who for a moment had stopped in his running upon limestone, which kept the impression of these footprints. And when I went there in 1940, the WPA worker was chiseling in the footprints of the angel, just restoring them at, I think, 50 cents an hour. And I used to talk to him, and he said, "I have to buy the baby shoes," he used to say, as he would explain to me this beautiful business of chipping in the angel's footprints. And the angel gave him the keys of paradise. And they believed, the Rappites believed all of this deeply.
He saw the angel Gabriel in a vision in New Harmony?
Well, he said he did. And of course, I simply reproduced the angel in my text from the book of Revelations and what I imagined this angel was like. And I have him meet him in the hop field, I believe it is, between the piggery and the orchard, and imagine that scene from the biblical descriptions of the angels, because everything was doomed except for this little people dwelling apart. And there, a little people who dwelled among the burnished reeds, like the baby Moses hidden, you know, away from the cruel king. And his sign was the golden rose of Micah. Eternal life was guaranteed for them so long as they kept their fraternity, brotherhood, and sisterhood. The women, according to an enlightened agnostic traveler from English Prairie, Illinois, were Amazonian, strong. They did the work of men in the fields. They wore skull caps, The men spoke with flute-like voices, so that you see that in these older people who had taken the vow of celibacy, because they really were finished with the sexual life anyhow, in all probability, there was a kind of change of sexes going on, whereas the young people were restless and wanted, if they could see the mare and the stallion mating, as they often must have, or the hen and the rooster, they couldn't understand why they should be under this edict against sexual life. And so sex would always rear up its ugly head, like individualism, when they began to be surrounded by all the comforts of life, honey, fresh baked bread, all the things that they enjoyed, while the average squatter was starving at the gates, never had much desire to enter this utopia. The squatter sat outside the gates of, I use the word gates not merely as a symbol of speech, but they sat outside the gates, and one is reported to have said about Father Rapp's utopia, "I studies it and I studies it." And he is said to have made the same remark about Robert Owen's utopia when Owen came there to establish upon this scene of the Eveless and Adamless Eden, so to speak, the community of free lovers, free thinkers. He didn't advocate free love, but there was freedom of woman, certainly, you know.
How did they relate to the story of Adam and Eve in the Bible, the Rappites?
They simply believed that the fall of man was caused by the serpent tempting Eve, just the regular version.
Were they always a celibate community, even in Germany?
They were in a very ambiguous state. Even in the early harmony, there were, according to a footnote of Lord Byron to a canto about them in Don Juan, he said he understood that there were babies born at certain times of the year, probably not at the harvest or the planting season. So there was some birth until they finally took the complete law or vow of celibacy. Lord Byron in Don Juan said that it was an economy he would not care to join, and that he did not think it would work because there was extinction at the end of the line for the Rappites.
How did they propagate themselves? Did they recruit
new
members?
There were some recruits coming from other places, I think from Germany, but sometimes he would, in one occasion, he took in a widower with a great many children, and would take in orphans who were wandering about in the wilderness and had nowhere to go. He was there. There weren't too many deaths. The malaria killed off people, but one of the things which impressed Robert Owen when he bought the property was that the mortality rate among the Rappites had steadily declined. There were two suicides in the community, but that's a small number. There were, I'm sure, suicides in every utopia. It's just that which fascinated me in the whole inquest into the irrational things about utopias, not only the positive but the negative factors which came into these two utopias, different as they were.
Did they have rituals to sublimate their drives?
They believed Father Rapp to be omniscient, everywhere, gifted with as many eyes as the eyes in the feathers of a peacock's tail. That was because he had an underground passage of which they did not know, and there were holes in it through which he could rear up his head. He wore a...
Into the houses?
No, in the landscape.
Oh.
He wore a peaked hat and had a beard, which was black, perhaps, at the beginning and white at the end. And he could see what they were doing. And they were not encouraged to stand and gossip. Even the doorways in New Harmony were built in such a way that your door, back door would never face another person's back door, therefore there would not be any back door gossip. Then he heard the confession of sins at the end of each day when he was like a priest before the congregation. They believed that he was almost divine, if not divine. Now you can well imagine that they did not say, "I have envied my neighbor's wife." What they did say was, "I have torn my coat. I have lost a button from my coat. I am careless. Or I threw out too much bread," something like that. Things which related to economy and to the conduct of the workers' day with an absolute machine-like efficiency. There were white flags at the edge of the property, and beyond that, the Rappites never went, and they also never learned the English language. So they were separated from the surrounding state by both their physical isolation and their lack of knowledge of English. There was one man, the cow's herd, who was allowed to wander off the estate in pursuing cows who got away. And he also drove a wagon called Noah's Ark, and on the side of the wagon was the community newspaper, which would tell people things like everyone will assemble at 3 o'clock or whatever it was. Then every evening there was the town crier going through the streets singing this beautiful song, "Another day passes, one step nearer the end." A little song which showed the end of time to each Rappite as he turned in toward sleep, in which the men were all in one kind of house and the women in another. They did not sleep in the same houses.
How was the community physically set up originally? Was it like a large housing unit for men?
No. There were beautiful, there was one large, beautiful old tavern where community business was done and where travelers could stop. Then there were these red brick houses with the sign of the cross in the doorway, and beautiful hand-baked brick, naturally. But it's all done with perfection. You can see it to this day when you go into these little houses. Then there were communal houses in which men and women were always separated. It was a small town, over a half mile square, surrounded by fields, orchards, there were great beehives, cocooneries, hatteries, places where they made coats. Whiskey was the greatest of all their products.
Is that how they supported themselves, with the whiskey trade?
With every kind of trade, nails, kegs, bricks, anything you wanted. It was an industrial hive in the middle of a disorganized wilderness where the average pioneer was isolated, alone, in the forest, in a cabin, and would not dare to open a door to a stranger. Oddly enough, I was always fascinated by the stories of early murders in the Indiana wilderness. You didn't dare to open your door at night because you didn't know who would be there. And the story is told that the word Hoosier, which many people ponder upon, comes from the fact that the old pioneer, I was thinking of him as old, he was probably young, the pioneer, when he heard someone knocking at his door, would say, "Hoosier." He was from the from Appalachia, the southern migration, and his wife, he would get the name of the person. His wife would open the door as he pointed with his rifle at the door, and if you were not the person you said you were, you would be shot. There is another explanation for the word Hoosier, that it was an Irish family of flatboat manufacturers who came over from the Kentucky shore, and they manufactured so many flatboats and had so many sons, their names were Hoosier, and that the whole state became known as the Hoosier State. But I think most people accept the Hoosier, and certainly Hoosiers lack it, because they still have a rugged individualism in that state today. We like to say in Indiana, we invented rugged individualism.
Marguerite, why did Father Raff build a maze on the banks of the river?
The maze was a symbol, really, of birth. It is man's search through the labyrinthine maze for the eternal symbol. And it was a reproduction of that which he had known in Württemberg. There were mazes in Hampton Court and yes. in Greece and Crete and in various other places. Some of them were built to the Blessed Virgin, but of course there was no Blessed Virgin at the center of the New Harmony maze. There was a little four-square building, and there was a golden book on a high shelf with very fine print, which was difficult to read, and which simply gave instructions for the building of a four-square piece of architecture. Now, this little golden book interests me because it came before Joseph Smith's discovery of the golden book of the angel Moroni, which he claimed to have discovered in a field in New York. But it came before the entire resurrectionist passion swept over America. However, the maze was supposed to confuse you as you try to turn right, left to get to the center or try to get out of it. It was a place for the Raffites to walk and meditate. And it had only this little log building at the center where they were supposed to think of the heavenly state, the paradise yet to come. The golden rose of Micah, which was a carving they had in stone or other decorative works to signify eternity. The world would end, and the entire universe, he said when he was old, was like one great animal of bisexual elements which must die. It was corrupt, but it would be born again. This interested me because the search for rebirth was part of Owen's vocabulary, even although he declared himself to have parted company with the mystical and the supernatural. And it also interested me because for so many Europeans, America was a paradisal land, a land of new beginnings. And for the Jesuits, as you remember, it was to be one vast utopian community in which there would be only Jesuits and converted Indians. Yeah. They had parted by the time Father Rapp came. They had departed. But the whole of America was blessed. You get this in one of Poe's poems in which a scholar in Italy is thinking of America as if it were the paradise, the paradiso world. Mm-hmm. All of America was a dreamlike continent to the Europeans who wished to escape from the from serfdom or slavery or lack of religious freedom, whatever, military conscription, whatever it was that they objected to. The odd thing about Owen was that although he had debated as a young man in Manchester, England, with Coleridge as to there being no supernatural spirits wandering about in the ether, no disembodied people with whom one could have communication, he still employed an extremely biblical and supernatural vocabulary at times, as do all utopists. This is very interesting. I find this true clear down to present studies I am doing of utopia in Indiana and in America, I might add, since they're almost not necessarily the same places at times. Owen believed that there were three states in the history of mankind. One was the old, mistaken, capitalistic state of the past. The second through which man would pass, and I think we're in it now, is that in which he is in an unknown sea battling through the storms upon a rudderless ship. He said, this is the most difficult time of all. You don't know where you're going or how you're going to get there, but you're trying. And the third state is that in which there would be his brand of cooperative socialism on a large scale. And he felt that this remote community in which everything had already been built was the ideal location for him. Now, he was born at Newtown in Wales, and when he was an old man, he returned there and said to a little boy who was playing on the sidewalk, do you know where Robert Owen was born? Of course, the little boy could know that he was talking to Robert Owen, who wore a high silk hat and had a beard. And he said, oh, yes, the great Mr. Owen was born right over there. And he pointed to that little house. Owen entered and climbed the stair to the room in which he was born, lay down on the bed and said, relief has come, and he died. I suppose then he passed into the true utopia, if there is one. But he found that the already made physical utopia suited his purposes when he left New Lanark, Scotland, cotton mills where he had established a partial utopias for the children of the and families of the cotton mill workers who had been treated like animals before him.
He was a capitalist then himself, a mill owner.
He was an enlightened capitalist who believed in a total change in the relationships of the individual and society. He believed in an enlightened egoism, which would become altruistic if one acted according to what he considered to be the immutable and unchanging laws of human nature. There were 12 laws, which he substituted for the 12, for the commandments, and he again had a belief that these were given in the nature of things. So he was again somewhat tending toward mysticism himself. Now, when I read of his debate with Coleridge in Manchester, I was absolutely fascinated, of course, loving Coleridge as I did. And then he went on into what he considered to be his absolutely rational history. And when he had lost the utopias, the communes had failed in a physical sense, if not in a spiritual sense, he became deaf and was somewhat cut off from communication with others, and he began to hear voices in the deep himself. Among them, the voice of Coleridge, the voice of Thomas Jefferson, the voice of the Duke of Kent, who was Queen Victoria's father, the voice of voices of various people who at one time or another either inspired his utopian quest or were a part of it themselves. The irrational in Owen was what appealed to me. Had he remained a strict materialistic rationalist all his life, I might not have found him such an appealing character as I did. The fact that he came over to voices and unearthly creatures. Now, Rapp disliked Thomas Jefferson. He liked Andrew Jackson, rugged individualism, you know, whereas Owen was a Jeffersonian. He believed in a Jeffersonian kind of democracy. He was going to reconstruct America. He was going to take down all the towns there were and build rectangular villages in America, England, everywhere. He was also going to, under the influence of an English architect named Whitwell, who built paper palaces, paper utopias, showing the divine housing project in the future. He was going to, very much like the housing projects today, by the way, he was going to rename every city in the world so that you would be able, by looking at the city, which would be two words, to locate it in exactly as to latitude and longitude. Everything would be renamed, every city in the world. Now, what interested me was that utopia, the dream of utopia, was never realized in its completion, and that it was a city outside every latitude and every longitude. You couldn't find it. It was nowhere. It was like Dickens' Castle Nowhere. You just could not really find it. You find beautiful aspects of it in both utopias, the Rappite and the Owenite. You find beautiful workmanship in the Rappite community, a certain devotion, and in the Owenite community, many of the ideas which have become familiar parts of American life, such as the education of women or the building of housing projects, in which there will be greenery surrounding the projects, so forth. But the whole thing is still a possibility for the future.
How long did Owen's community last, and why did it fail?
Well, he was warned by John Quincy Adams that his utopian community would not find the correct environment in America. And he came, however, immediately to New York. He was determined that it would. He was also warned by a visiting Englishman who lived just across the Wabash that, well, first this Englishman told him how beautiful it was and recited Pope's essay on man about the poor, the Indian, and the beautiful children of nature. But then when he saw that Owen was actually intent upon sinking his fortune into this project, he said, oh, don't go. It is not like that. It's not a poem, and told him how difficult the life was there. Owen was not afraid of that life. And I think, I'm not certain that I was altogether conscious of this when I was writing it, because I was much younger than I am now. But I think that he was also at that point in life where he wanted to leave home anyhow, a separate life, a more adventuresome life, away from all the old familiar roots. He was in his middle age and restless. I think his children were grown. He went immediately and gave a lecture to the United States Congress describing his plans for the future of America, with little sense that he was facing most rugged individuals there ever were. They were all exploiting and expanding. They were in no mood to tear down what they just built and build rectangular cities and rename all the cities that they built. And they warned him, asked questions about what about the malaria, what about the drainage, they had heard it was poor, what about this, that, and the other. And he simply dismissed all those ideas and invited all the people of America to go there, so that everyone who was discontented with his present situation could go to New Harmony, and they did. There were hundreds there by the time he arrived, and they represented every kind of adventurer you ever heard of. It was, to them, it seemed like a free life had been offered to them, with only a few hours' work. There was to be no money, and they were to be paid in the coinage of the community, paper tabs to show how much they worked. But everything was to be free, easy, comfortable, so that he didn't have a highly selected population to begin with. He had every hermit crawled out of the cave. Every man who had been sleeping in a tree hollow decided to go to New Harmony, where Owen had promised a free life. And there were then the beautiful satirical poems in the capitalistic press about Owen. One was that the devil was, who had been building a great hole at the North Pole, should give up that and just come to New Harmony. He would find a greater hole there for the sinking of the human race, and so on. And there were all kinds of jokes about it. He went and gave his lecture, his opening speeches to the community, and very shortly afterwards he left, returning to finish some of his own business in England. He left his son as a representative of him. The son was a practical man and did not believe from the beginning that the community could succeed, because nobody was doing any work. They were all discussing happiness and their ideals of happiness. Then he came back with his second son, Robert Dale Owen, And on that boat, there was a circus manager with a team of dwarves, and he was making them practice on wires strung between the masts in the pitching storm. And Owen said that if he sent them up again, he would kill him. He would throw him overboard. Owen was a pacifist, but even a pacifist could be aroused. That was a premonition, in a way, of the failure to come, I think. By the way, I forgot to say that when Father Rapp finally died in economy, a man who was the chief property owner there opened a puppet show, and I always thought of both the dwarfs and the puppets as symbolic of this desire to arrange all things in life, to manipulate people away from the individual errors that they might commit. When he came back, his son was in the lobby of a New York hotel when a man who called himself Page sent in his calling card asking to see him. This was a green calling card upon which there was green writing, and the man was dressed in green from head to foot, had green curls, a green complexion, and introduced himself as the fool of nature. He said, "I see that Mr. Owen has solved all the mysteries of nature, but he doesn't know the nature that I know," and so on. I reproduced that speech in the book. This frightened Robert Dale Owen very much. Again, a premonition of failure. When they came to New Harmony, Owen returning for the second time, everyone was looking forward to what they called the second coming of one, as if he were Jesus Christ returning. They came by a boat which they called the Maid of Mist, or the Boatload of Knowledge, and they set sail from Pittsburgh, but at the wrong time of the year, and not far from the Rappi original community, the boat was frozen by ice blocks and was stalled for a long time.
Who was on that boat, Mark?
That boat contained, it was called the Boatload of Knowledge because it contained a great many of the experts in the fields of geography, geology, botany, conchology, and every other imaginable subject, as he wished to make this an Athens or paradise for scientists. And they were the intellectuals of the community. And then there were the mechanics, or laborers, and it was not long before the mechanics and the intellectuals were having battles, because the mechanics objected to the intellectuals objected to the mechanics, and there was social snobbery within the community, caused simply by the way they fell into the classes they had escaped.
Was there a division of labor, and were they able to eliminate sexual roles? Were women equal to men there?
Women were supposedly equal to men, and well, I'm sure they were, but they objected to their equality, because after you had brought up your family, for instance, to find that suddenly you were the mother of every child in the community annoyed some women very much. They did not want to have responsibility for children after they had brought up their own, so they also felt that they were overworked, and they missed the capitalistic world. There was one family there, Mr. and Mrs. Pierce, and they wrote letters to Benjamin Bakewell, who was a glassblower and always yearned to know whether human nature could be blown into new forms as a glassblower blows glass, and he'd always doubted it. And he was in Pittsburgh, and they kept writing letters to tell of the misfortunes that they suffered in New Harmony as they waited for Robert Owen's return. Mrs. Pierce said she felt as if she were out of the world, and she quoted melancholy English poets of the graveyard school to tell how miserable she was and her daughter Mariah was. Mr. Pierce was so filled with debits and credits, he who had escaped capitalism was now the community bookkeeper, that he couldn't see straight. He also seems to have had some consolation from drinking whiskey. And one time a goat got into his office and ate all the papers which listed the assets and liabilities of the community. And he was fired for negligence. I think he got his job back in a few days. But everything was chaos in that second delightful, utterly delightful New Harmony. Robert Dale Owen said that with all that they suffered, he would look back upon that as the most enchanted period of his youth, like going upon a wonderful picnic, and, you know, the birds, the beasts, the flowers were there. One day, however, this was a scene which greatly appealed to me. He looked out of the window of the old hotel where Robert Owen boasted that he lived for 6 cents a day. Mm-hmm. I lived there in 1940 in his room and had a great hole in the floor, and we used to be scared to death as we walked around it for fear someone would fall through it into the lobby below. He looked out the window and he saw an old man in the community. His name was Mr. Greenwood, walking up and down in a thunderstorm, holding an iron bar in his hands, and he called down to him, "Why do you carry that iron bar through the thunder and the lightning?" And the old man said, "I'm praying to God to strike me dead." So there was someone who wanted to die in Utopia, so to speak. The Duke, there was one man who visited New Harmony, and he said that the place enraged him, because every time he sent his shirts to the community laundry, he got back the wrong size. And he said, "You can keep your utopias, but I do want my own shirts."
You have been listening to a talk with Marguerite Young on her book, Angel in the Forest. The program was produced at WBAI by Charles Potter, with technical production by David Rapkin. Marguerite Young on Angel in the Forest was directed by Charles Ruas. Assistant Director, Rob Wynn. This is David Rapkin. Thank you for listening. The previous program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms, WGXC 90.7 FM.